Amen. All right, so I just have to comment before we get started today that last week's message, I don't know how it affected you guys, but it's got to be one of the most profound expositions I've ever heard of that. I've heard that passage. I've been through it in school. I have never heard it that way in terms of seeing the humanity and the deity of Christ. It's such an amazing theological argument. Even in his manhood on the cross, right, not giving in at the end, right, and just saying, okay, forgive them, right? So expressing perfect forgiveness as man, and then we see at the end of the passage, right, that forgiveness as deity. It was just, for me, it's one of the most profound ones that I've ever heard. I sent Mark a note, and I said, I didn't realize how superficial my understanding of the passage was until I heard that. So it really was, I thought, a wonderful capstone, and I think just an unbelievable kind of segue into the way he'll conclude this week with the gospel. I mean, it is the essence of the gospel in terms of that foundation. So it really was profound, and hope it was for you all as well. Announcement-wise, next 3 weeks is going to be a little different. Mark is going to take Sunday school for the next 2 weeks, and he's going to do a Q&A. Okay? So he had mentioned maybe doing it from the pulpit. I think the elders encouraged him to use this time and take a couple weeks to do that. So come with your questions, come with your thoughts, come with anything about the series that we've been through in terms of practical questions and applications. He'll do that on the 12th. I think you've seen the announcements. We're going to have a combined service down at the South Campus, which many of you helped out yesterday cleaning up. It'll be, I just think, an amazing event to have everybody together. We'll see a bunch of new members, some baptisms, so it'll be a blow. You guys are joining us. That'll be wonderful. So please mark that on your calendars. Don't miss that. I think it'll be just a sweet time of fellowship together. So I'll then be off for 3 weeks, and then we'll come back again after that. So what I'm going to do today is just try to wrap up chapter 6, okay? And then we'll leave 7. I'll just kind of give an introduction to 7 through 11 in terms of kind of the structure and the outline of those passages. But there's a lot to chew on here in chapter 6 and a whole lot of questions that we get to answer in these first four verses. So, Dan, would you read the first four verses for us to get started here?
Genesis 6, 1. When man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown.
Okay, so let me just kind of roll back real quick. We go back to Genesis 1. We have creation. Genesis 2, we see the perfect environment, the perfect marriage. Genesis 3, we see the fall and the curse. Genesis 4, we see the cycle of sin repeated again with Cain and Abel. And then we see the intensification of sin with Lamech. Chapter 5, or at the end of chapter 4, we see the new godly line through Seth. Chapter 5, we see the genealogy leading us up to this time with Noah. Now, as Moses returns here in chapter 6, we're coming back to the general condition of humanity. So we've kind of seen the two humanities, if you will, the sinful humanity and then the godly remnant or line. And now we're going to see the general humanity, the condition that we see on earth. So we left off last week, and we said that there were three interpretive issues, at least, in these first four verses. So what were the three interpretive issues we got to work our way through?
Sons of God.
Right. Who were the sons of God? And then companion to that, and the daughters of men. Right. What's the second thing we have to figure out?
120 years.
What's the 120 years talking about? And then what's the third thing?
Nephilim,
yeah. Who are the Nephilim? Okay, and kind of how does that all go together? Now, I asked you to think about the purpose, right? Why so much apparent difficulty or challenge in these verses? Anybody have a chance to reflect on that and maybe try to think through what's God doing here in this process?
He's beginning to show the multiplication of the human race, but also the wickedness that was on earth. That's what the rest of the chapter is about.
Right. Right. Yeah, and I think that gets to the point. So we'll kind of come to the end of that. I think there are kind of two big application takeaways that we can look at when we get to the end of that. But I think the general idea here is let's see what's happening on Earth, okay? It would have clearly meant something to that original audience and been clear to them. Doesn't mean it wasn't clear to them, but certainly a little bit more confusing to us. So the three interpretive issues. So the first one is this issue of who are the sons of God and the daughters of men? So we'll take a look at trying to answer that question, and then we'll try to figure out what the issue is here. So what are the two options? There are three options, but there's two primary options. Anybody read about them? What are they?
Yeah. Angels,
right?
The line of Seth, or kings.
Yeah, right. So the angels and the lines of Seth are really the two big ones. A third one that doesn't get a lot of attention is that, and it ties into the idea of the Nephilim, which is kind of a rogue set of kings or powerful men on earth. But we come down to the process. So it's an interesting challenge. We won't unravel it, okay? It was the first paper I wrote in when I went to seminary, and I think I told you that I did 8-point font and about 0.5-inch margins. I thought 2-page papers were easy. And then you realize, no, they're not easy. The longer ones are easy because you have more time to talk about stuff. In 2 pages double-spaced, you got to get to the point, get salient points, and then conclude something. And so it was hilarious. I couldn't believe it. Every time I thought I had it figured out, I'd read another commentary and say, I don't have it figured out. All right, so angels. Angels is the normal way to read the text. Okay, so sons of God in the Old Testament, in these three references in Job, are very clearly references to angels. Okay, so that's the strongest support for interpreting sons of God as angels in the passage. It's the normal usage of the language, and that's usually a fairly strong and decisive. But context works against this view, right? We've been talking about men. We've been talking about depravity and sinfulness in men. So where do angels come from? They come out of nowhere. Okay, so why all of a sudden the switch in context to angels? Although you could, on the flip side to that, argue, well, maybe God wants to show that it's really
rampant.
Totally rampant, okay, and totally depraved, and it's not only in the, you know, physical world, but in the spiritual world. So there's an argument that you can say for that. We have also arguing against that the Matthew 22 passage in verse 30, right, where it says angels don't marry. You know, the commentators say, well, you know, that's right, but, you know, it's not talking about marriage here. It's talking about coming into the women. And I'm like, okay, but isn't marriage the purpose for... So, you know, it is an argument that angels don't marry, and you could point to that as a possible reason for not. The one that's probably the most compelling for me, and I'll tip my hand by saying this now, is if it's angels, then how come there's no punishment, right? Because if the focus and the purpose of understanding the angels to be the sons of God, what happens afterwards? Okay, the world and mankind is punished, right? So it seems to me a little discordant that God would mete out a punishment on somebody other than the one he's passing judgment on. So for me, personally, that's the hardest one for me to get around, okay? On all these, however, we will not be dogmatic. Yes?
You don't think that the passage in 2 Peter that you're talking about, those punishments?
I don't. You know, there's the two passages in Peter, 1 and 2 Peter. There's the passage in Jude. I went back and studied them. I didn't really dig into the Greek, okay? They argue that they're tied, but I don't think they're... I think they're just examples, okay? Jude is the closest one, because Jude kind of ties it back. But then when they... Boyce, who I like, says, well... The problem with in Sodom and Gomorrah was that they wanted to have relationships with the angels. Well, they didn't know they were angels, number one. Number two, it's homosexuality, I think, is the issue that's on display there. So, again, I don't want to beat this down as a wrong interpretation. Either of these, you can pick your favorite coin and you can flip it, and if it ends up on the side of the coin, great. But if it comes up head or tails, I think you can go either way. So I think the Jude passage is the closest that I would argue for that. I think the other ones are not. I think it's just both the Peter passages, and I read them several times. It's just like, okay. Now, we all have our what when we come to the text?
Presuppositions.
Our presuppositions. And so my presupposition in the way I was taught,
yeah,
okay, was the other way. So my presuppositions may be influencing me there. So it's fair to say that those are arguments in favor. Now, the Sethites... The biggest thing against this is it goes against the normal meaning of language, okay? Because sons of God, as I said, in the Old Testament is angels. However, on the other side of it is, it's not completely foreign, right? We are sons of God. We're adopted children. Again, I'm kind of applying Old New Testament language to the Old Testament, so I'm breaking my rule, right? What I know about the New Testament, I can't apply back because we haven't read this yet, okay? But they argue that. The idea for me, though, is it's more consistent with the context we've been in, okay? So we've been learning and reading about the depravity on earth, the intensification of sin, and so the context now is, and we've also known that there's going to be a struggle, right, from back in Genesis 3 between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman, right? Seed of the serpent, in addition to angels, which you could say supports angels, is also what? All non-believers as well. So, you know, you've got the clash of the non-believing and believing world, and you've got both of those there. But the context for me is more consistent. Genesis 4 introduces the godly line. So maybe it's the idea of indiscriminate marriage or multiple wives. We'll talk about that in a second. But there is possibly a sin. And then the judgment is on mankind. Okay, so, you know, the judgment seems to fit, quote, quote, the crime, which seems to be, to me, the more logical of the two. Either one of these solutions are orthodox. Either one can be supported. None of us have to break fellowship over this one, okay? But we'll get to, again, this idea of, you know, why the confusion? It would have been clear to the original readers, okay? They would have known exactly what was going on. We're separated by time. Now, who's the daughter? Who are the daughters of men, right? Is it women in general, right? Just women in general, daughters of men? Is it women of Cain's line as a proxy for unbelievers? Now, I think even though as much as I support the idea of Sethites, I think this reads a lot into the text, right? Because where did we, I mean, we know Cain's line was sinful, right? And we do know that Cain's line was opposed to God and his thing. But where would they have known that they could or couldn't intermarry, right? I mean, that's not until later. We're not going to get that until
there's
we get into
it. There's only so many women at the beginning.
Right.
To choose from.
Good point. Only so many sisters to choose from, right? But so the point of this is, you know, the daughters of men to me is even more obscure. Yeah. But I think we learned something about them in the fact that the way they're characterized as beautiful or attractive or good or pleasant, okay? So I think the emphasis here more so is on what's attracting them as opposed to what line they particularly belong in. So, what could the issue be? Well, it could be taking multiple wives, right? It does say they took wives, plural. And we've had that idea introduced just back in chapter 4. What did Lamech do, right? So as sin intensified, I did 70 times 7, right? I took multiple wives. You know, I killed a mere boy for just harming me or bruising me. So you see this intensification idea. It could be choosing wives for the wrong reason. I think that's as far as you can go with that, for just external appearances or maybe fulfilling lust or things of that nature. It could be intermarriage of believers or unbelievers. I think that's a longer stretch. Or it could be this idea of angels leaving their habitation, right, and indwelling human beings and engaging in sexual acts through that process. We do know that demons do possess us, right? So it's very plausible, not us, right? Can possess people, let's say, human beings, not any of us, right? But, so it could be that the angels were leaving their habitation. And, you know, again, in that argument, I think the strongest case for that is normal sense of the language, and a kind of an expression of the total depravity, okay? And so, again, either of those are fine. You can go with either argument. The point of it is, so do we know who they are, the sons of men?
Not definitively.
Not definitively, okay. Well, I think I have it there. So we can't be dogmatic. You know, it's likely pointing out some form of sexual immorality that was pervasive, right? And so, you know, you think of our society today. What is some of the most pervasive sin that we have? You know, it's sexual immorality. I mean, and it is just expressed in so many horrible ways, and now with technology, it can go crazy, right? So we see this pattern from the very earliest of times in something there. So, question number two, what does the 120 years refer to? What are the options there? Anybody know what the options there are?
Lifespan?
Lifespan is one.
Or the total time till the judgment.
Right, okay. So the two options there that people point to is 120 years is pointing to either the new lifespan of man, right? Because up till now it's been what?
Massive.
Long, okay. Or it's God saying that how long he's going to strive with them before the flood, okay? So lifespan of man, but Abraham was 175. Okay, so you can't dogmatically jump on that one. But you do see at this point a dramatic reduction in lifespan. Okay, so we start to see that process coming down. And what do we say today? I mean, somebody lives to what? 100 years old. That's a big deal,
yeah.
Right? So I think we see that pattern borne out over time. So it does drop quickly. And the time to the flood came in 100 years, not 120 years, okay? Now, I do prefer this one. For the simple reason that when we get to chapter 7, you're going to see tremendous precision on the part of the author on days. You know, 7 days to this, and then X days to this, and X days to this, okay? So there's so much precision about the flood, and I think there'll be reasons for that, just to make sure people truly understand it as a worldwide flood. I would tend to lean towards the lifespan of man in this process, okay? And then, you know, you've got this idea here also, you know, even in verse 3, more than just 120 years, you know, the Lord said, my spirit, you know, shall not. You said, abide. What are you reading from? What's your version?
ESV.
ESV, okay.
So abide in man, but there's a note that says,
right.
My spirit shall not contend with.
Yeah, contend with, strive. The problem is the word here is hapax legomena, which means used only one time. Okay, it's usually only one time. It's also noted as potentially dubious, and then there are some textual variants associated with it. So it's one of those words that's used infrequently, and it's hard to do. So not strive with man forever, because he is also flesh.
Is that what the base meaning of the word is?
It's, you know,
fighting,
some
contending?
There isn't. It's only one time. Some people think it's actually should be the word deen. Hebrew word D-I-N, think of it that way, and that word means judgment, okay? So it's yadon, yeah, so it's one of those ones where you see it only one time, and it's kind of hard to do it. I think striving, abiding, I think abiding is a little interpretive,
yeah.
Right? Because it says, where do we know from the Old Testament that the Spirit, which is generally capitalized in your Bibles, is actually abiding or, you know, indwelling? I don't think we see the indwelling of the Spirit in the Old Testament. I think we see the empowerment for service in the Old Testament with the Holy Spirit. So I think that probably gets a little interpretive. But then also this idea of, so the reason for not striving is what? Because he is flesh. So what? I mean, the flesh is kind of hard to figure out. So what's the flesh representing right here?
Wickedness.
Yeah, wickedness, but more generally, though, I mean, we don't know that yet, do we? I mean, we don't understand spirit and flesh and sin nature and, you know, the flesh and so forth. But so this word in Hebrew, basar, is a general word also. It can mean flesh as in the physical part of man, but God created our flesh, right? So why would he not abide with something or strive with something he created? So here the word probably more likely refers to mankind in general. So I won't continue to strive for mankind with mankind in general forever, okay? And I think actually when we go back, when I get to the end of this little section here, this verse will kind of point out the ultimate application of these verses, okay? Kind of what it is that I think we should take away, or the point, if you will, okay? So two options there could be either the age of man becoming no more than 120, which I prefer, or the time to the flood. Either one has problems. So again, you can flip that same coin. If it ends up right on the middle, great. But if it's heads or tails, you can go with which one you want. Who are the Nephilim? How do they relate to the sons of God? The term literally means mighty men. So because, again, it's one of these hard words to interpret from the Hebrew, they just transliterate it. Okay, so Nephilim is exactly what the word is. It's taking the Hebrew consonants and vowels, and transliterating it into our consonants and vowels, okay? What it generally means is mighty men. It makes the point that the mighty men were present before and after the sons of God. So I don't think you can say that these mighty men were the progeny, necessarily, of the angels coming into the daughters of men, which some people try to argue. It's most likely corrupt dynastic rulers, okay? So mighty men, you know, men of renown. It's kind of interesting, actually, there's a funny play here. The word that is translated in most of your Bible, so at the end of verse 4, I don't know, NASB has, those were mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Right? Everybody pretty much have renown in their versions, okay? So that word renown is actually this Hebrew word shame, okay? Which is Seth's, Shem's name, okay? So Shem, the men of Shem, okay, proceeding out of the line of Seth, so you could possibly say that it's there. I don't think that's it. So that is also the same word for name as well, translated name. So what's the point? I mean, why so much interpretive difficulty as he transitions into these first four verses? Okay, and I think Dan basically captured it. It is to set the stage. Okay, it's context for what's going to start to follow in verses 5 and ongoing. And the point here is we may not understand every detail, right? But the message is pretty clear, right? The world's what? It's a mess, right? I mean, it's a mess. So the idea here isn't that we need to know who the sons of God are, or who the Nephilim are, or who the daughters of women are, but rather we need to understand that sin has now spread to the whole earth, okay? And as a result of that, God's going to do some things. But kind of even more than that, I think these are the two things that it strikes me from an application point of view. The first is that a world that doesn't fear God, right, is a world that is a scary place. Right, so we just think of the history of America, right? You founded, who was it told me they went to D.C. recently? You? Forgot. Somebody told me they went to D.C. and they said they went to all the monuments. And you go to the monuments, you see D.C. and you read our Declaration of Independence. You read different things. You see all the things the fathers say. God's all over it, right? Where is God most prominently? And the thing we love the most. He's right on the money. In God we trust, right? We have this little green stuff that we use in the meantime, but in God we trust. So the fact is, as we see a country here that fears God less and less, we see a country that is beginning to implode on itself and the various different things. So a world that doesn't fear God, and clearly this world did not fear God at this time, is a scary place. But then I think the other one, which is the other big application here, is there is an end to God's patience, right? So though there is a reason for it, right? 2 Peter 3, 8 to 10 talks about he's not slow, a day is not a year. So why is he not slow? Because he wants everybody to come to faith that they can. But it's very clear that he will judge, okay? So, and when he judges and when the time comes, it will be decisive. So again, I think the key here is not to get hung up on trying to figure out who the sons of God are, who the daughters of men are, who the Nephilim are. The point here is that the world has become a mess, total mess. Depravity has spread everywhere, okay? A world that doesn't fear God is a scary place to live. And on top of that, God's patience is not going to last forever, okay? He is long-suffering, no question. The Bible tells us it's his very essential attribute, right? But he is. Yes, Dan.
Kind of get the feeling the first four verses are a little bit of a prologue and almost a little bit of an inside information for people that may have understood it better than us.
Right, yeah.
Of course, you could just start the chapter with verse 5, and we probably wouldn't know anything different.
Yeah.
But maybe it's like for the children of Israel, this was kind of an explanation, kind of prologue, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way to say it. It's a prologue. I mean, it's an introduction. Yeah, Don.
Is it safe to say, I mean, we look at the first five chapters, preparation for universal judgment. I mean, everybody except for the family of Noah is going to be wiped off the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
They had no idea of that because they couldn't foresee that the flood was coming.
Right.
But then the flood comes and makes an exclamation point like that. I mean what I say.
Right.
You have been disobedient, and so radically disobedient that this is the result of your sin. And it could happen again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, doesn't it say that in the New Testament? Yeah.
But wasn't Noah called a preacher of righteousness, and wouldn't his ark have been a testimony for years to those around, whether or not they thought he was a madman?
I think it's an interesting point. I don't know how far I go with preacher of righteousness. We're going to learn about his character in verse 5, and he's going to be called a righteous man, so yes. I do think it's a testimony, and the testimony is when you go back through any ancient culture, okay, as David points out, there is some form of a flood story. Now, some of them are quite fanciful, okay, but every culture has some evidence of a flood account. So what does that tell us about the nature or the extent of the flood? It's a worldwide flood, okay? So yeah, I think David's point is a good point. So, you know, the ark is a testimony, right? It's a testimony to faithfulness. It's a testimony to his obedience and so forth, yeah.
In fairness, 2 Peter does say that Noah was a herald of righteousness.
Yeah,
2 Peter 2:5.
Yeah, 2:5.
Okay. Teacher stands corrected. He was a herald of righteousness.
And of course, they didn't listen, but I think your point's well.
Yeah. No, clearly, he was a herald of righteousness. And verse 5 tells us that very thing, right?
Yeah.
Is that verse 5 or verse... Where am I? I'm getting ahead of myself. We're going to see Noah's character. We're going to see Noah's character down in verse 8. So, clearly, you know, he was a righteous man. Yes, sir.
Well, tagging on to what he said there, Kurt, talking about this, regardless of who he's talking about, referring to Philip and the daughters of men and all of that, they would have all been wiped out after the flood. So they weren't even, didn't even exist after the flood. They
right.
were gone.
Right.
There was no way for their lineage to be carried on, whoever they were,
right.
whoever they were.
Right.
Because only Noah and his family survived the flood.
Right.
And they weren't a part of that process.
Yep. So, yeah.
Whatever reason God tells us here, they're gone and no more.
Right. Yeah. So the whole point.
No way to carry on your lineage.
Right. So the non-technical conclusion is, so what? Right. He's up. No, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. In the end, so what? I mean, right. None of them are around. Okay. Nobody's around to tell us who it was, unless Noah wanted to tell us later. Apparently didn't. But yeah. So what, David? Did you have something else you were? Okay. And it is interesting. I hadn't really thought about what Dan said. If you did read, you know, we talk about parentheticals in the text, and, you know, this isn't highlighted by one of those dash-dash things. But if you did skip over verses 1 to 4, you know, verse 5 would be perfectly understandable after you read verse 32, right? So then we have this line, okay? And then, right, the story continues. This is what's going on, right? Because we have a repetition again of that genealogical line, right? And then we go on to the rest of the story. So I think the key point here is we're just getting context, okay? We're getting context on the things of the earth. You know, maybe for them it would have been clear. Maybe for us the point is simply to say that, look, God's going to judge, but he's going to judge righteously. There's going to be conditions that are going to draw his wrath, and as he does, you know, he's perfectly just in what he does. And so we see that process.
I think that's repeated in 2 Peter and Jude, too. We talk exactly about that, these scenarios.
Right.
Same thing.
Right. Right. Okay. All right. So God's response to the conditions, okay? Verses 5 to 8. Who would read those verses for me, please? Adam?
Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made him.
Okay. Verse 8.
But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord.
Okay. So what version are you reading from?
This is New King James.
Okay. So it says grace. Okay. Interesting. All right. It is the right interpretation, I think. The reason I'm asking is, if I could have my perfect Bible based upon the text, the original text, I would have a NASB Old Testament and a New King James New Testament based upon the different texts that I think are more accurate texts. But it is interesting. Okay, so first response is he pronounces a condemnation, okay, in verse 5. The reason for that is what? Every thought of mankind was continually evil, right? Continually evil. So every thought, okay, of mankind, that's everybody, was continually evil, notwithstanding the righteous Noah, who we're going to see as an exception. The source of wickedness is the heart, right? So we see this heart issue very early in the Bible, right? So one of the things I think is wonderful about this particular church is the emphasis that it has on biblical counseling. You know, and the essence of biblical counseling is to understand the issues and idols of the heart as you are dealing with issues in life, right? So you've got Christian counseling, which kind of combines secular psychological techniques with biblical verses. Biblical counseling looks at the source of the issues in the heart, okay? And it has always been about the heart, and we're all quite familiar with this Jeremiah passage. So God sees the inside. And again, the point of verses 1 to 4 is to explain the depth of depravity. Now, God's focus is on what was going on, not who, because everyone was doing it. Okay, so again, this whole idea of pervasiveness of sin on the face of the earth at this point in time. Next, God shows his heart, okay, in verse 6. So this is an example of what is known as anthropomorphic or anthropopathic, if you want to do emphasize on the emotional aspects, but this kind of language in the Bible attributes human characteristics to God. And it does it for one simple reason, and that is to help us understand him better, okay? So what's the idea here? I mean, is God changing his mind, or is he reacting to something that he didn't expect to happen? Now, what is it? What are we trying to say here in this verse?
Is God a man that he should change his mind?
Right, that's right, you can't do that. So what do we see here?
Yeah, exactly.
We're seeing an expression of God's grief, right? So, you know, why does God give us these kinds of insights? Why does he do that?
Sounds like an insight into his character. How mm-hmm. much he despises his sin.
Yeah, could be. Cain?
Or communicate to us on how much.
No helpful note, Dad. You can pass if you want.
I think it's to show God his emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're exactly right. I think he wants to show us an aspect of his character. He's relational, right? And we're relational. So I think she's exactly right on. Okay? I mean, we're made in his image. One aspect of his image is he is relational. Now, Kayan, anytime I do that in the future and you don't like it, just answer in Chinese. We'll all say, right. Okay.
No, I'm just surprised that I would start thinking about it. You're recalling me. Okay. I haven't finished my thought,
myself. So. Yeah, I say, don't open your mouth. I heard a peep over there. Very good. No, but I think that's right. I mean, you know, God wants us to see his heart. He wants us to understand that we're created in his image. He is relational. He does, and I think Don captured it. He grieves over this. I mean, he's not happy about this. God doesn't want to have to go through this process. So we see that. We get some insight into his character. Then in verse 7, we see him pass out the judgment, okay? Now, the word here in the Hebrew is literally blot out. It's a strong, strong verb. We see it again in Deuteronomy. Go to chapter 9 of Deuteronomy, and let's look at verse 14. Deuteronomy 9, verse 14. Okay, so this is reflecting on the golden calf incident, right? Let me alone that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven, and I will make you a nation mightier and greater than they. Okay, so we have this instance where God does carry through with this, right, in the Genesis flood account. But this is also reflecting on the very same thing. Again, we see that depravity, okay, develop again quickly in the nation, right? God's chosen people, the golden calf incident, they're worshiping that. And he, I think, in that point is testing Moses, right? See if Moses says, yeah, great, give me my own people. We'll do it all over again. But no, he says, for your name's sake, don't do it this way. So he doesn't blot that out, okay? Now, we also know that he can't do that, right? Well, that's another reason we know that he can't blot them all out. Now, he's just talking about the nation, right? He made a promise that he wouldn't do that again. Now, it is centered on the nation here, though, but nevertheless. Okay, so blotting out, strong word. But God always has a remnant, right? We talked about this before. We saw that. Cain kills Abel. Oh, good, Satan won. He's going to get them all off the face of the earth. No, God, you know, is with her again. He abides with her. He has a new seed. And this is actually the first instance of the word grace in the Bible. Okay, so the Hebrew word is chen, and it means favor or grace. Okay, so in any case, you can see that that it says Noah found NASB favor. What's ESV got?
Favor.
King James, grace. Okay. But it is the first instance of the Hebrew word for grace. Okay, so whether favor or whether grace, the point is that God does have grace, and we begin to see this whole process of it. Now, what do we see about this one that is going to preserve mankind? What do you note about his character, okay, as opposed to the character of everything we've seen? What do you see in verse 9? Three attributes of his character. Right, okay. So these are generations of Noah. Noah was a what?
Righteous
man.
Blameless.
Blameless in his time or generation. That's pretty interesting. And he walked with God. Okay. So, you know, we've got the idea here of Noah being kind of the polar opposite, right, of the condition that's on earth. So he was a righteous man. So this was his status before God. The Hebrew word here is tzaddik. He's a blameless man, kind of his relation says among the generations, okay, so among the people around him. So he's seen as a man of integrity around by all those that are around him. And most importantly is this last idea, he's an obedient man, okay, and we're going to see the whole chapter end on this quick and very summary note. But right, he walked with God. What does it mean to walk with God? Okay, I think the simplest thing is to think is that we obey his commandments, right? So he clearly walked with God, all right? So we have a man of quite significant contrast, apparently the only one, right, out of all the people that were there. So God always has a remnant. And then he repeats his progeny, okay, in verse 10. So he repeats the genealogy in the process.
Like
yeah.
The word order. That's good.
What's that?
The unusual word order.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, with God, Noah walked. Yeah, so it is interesting. I mean, there usually Hebrews grammatically, as Don was probably learning, when you get to your Greek, you're going to find the Greek grammar is a lot harder. Hebrew grammar is very straightforward. So when it does something different, it's really noticeable. So it's word order and it's grammatical order. So with God, he walked. Okay, so that the with God is the direct object,
yeah,
which would normally come later.
Flips
it and wants to put the emphasis there. Okay, with God. Oh, okay. Pretty good idea. So, the condition of the earth in verses 11 and 12, okay, so we've heard about the kind of the moral corruption. What's new about the condition of the earth here in verses 11 and 12? What additional things going on here?
Violence.
Violence, right? Okay, so now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Okay, so we now have violence marking the physical condition of the earth. Corruption marks the moral condition. So we have kind of a spiritual and a physical depravity. There's nothing left untouched in this whole process now as we go through it. Now, what is the source of this depravity here? What does it say? Where's the source? We know it's the heart, but what does it say more specifically about that? Right, so they have corrupted their way. They have corrupted their way, right? So it's the choices of men, right? Corruption is always a choice. Sin is always a choice, right? We saw that in the garden. It's always a choice to think, say, or do something contrary to what God wants us to think, say, or do. And as you think about sin, again, I've referenced Pastor Eric several times because I love the little exposition he did on James 1, right? It's not sin until you act on it, okay? Now you're thinking about it, okay, you lost, yeah, you're thinking, okay, that's bad. We know that in the Sermon on the Mount. We get that scenario. But, you know, it's this kind of dance you're doing with sin, right? What are you doing? You're kind of one step forward, one step back, two steps forward, one step back. Right? You're kind of working your way into the process, okay? You're working up to it, and you're rationalizing it, and you're thinking about it, and you're doing all those things, but at some point, you make the volitional decision to choose to sin. Okay, so it always comes back to that. So it's not something that was God caused to happen to them. It's not some external force that was causing the earth, I mean the men on the earth, to do this kind of thing. It was the choice of them. All the hearts were continually wicked, evil all the time. Okay, so kind of told the depravity. Now, what are the objects of the destruction? Let's, in verse 13. Then God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. And behold, I'm about to destroy them with the earth. So what are the objects of the destruction? What's God going to destroy when we get to the flood?
All flesh.
All flesh. What else?
And the earth.
And the earth, okay? This with the earth is kind of an interesting little preposition at the end, right? So he's going to destroy all the flesh with the earth, right? So I think I've mentioned before this book by Whitcomb, The Genesis Flood. It's, you know, it's a really good read if you want to do any kind of apologetic work, understanding about what, you know, when you argue against geologists and different people about why is the earth look the way it does today. You read about the things that can come out of a worldwide flood, right? And the pressures that would have put on the earth and the things it would have done geologically to the earth. And you get a sense of what really did happen, okay? So it wasn't just that mankind was destroyed. The whole earth itself was recast in the context of this flood, okay? Yeah, so you see that. So mankind and earth itself, which is, actually, with is better, together with. So the earth along with everything on the earth is going to be destroyed is what it's really saying there. So why is the earth added? I think personally it's added there just to kind of set up the fact that, it's not just mankind, but we're going to see a real reshaping and reforming of the earth. And again, probably just one of those little apologetic things God put into the Bible. So when you come back and hear all the scientists say X, Y, and Z, you come back and say, no, God said he was going to do this, and he did it. Now, the means of preservation, verses 14 to 22. So somebody read those verses for me, please, 14 to 22.
Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. You shall make the ark with rooms and shall cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall make it. The length of the ark, 300 cubits. Its breadth, 50 cubits, and its height, 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark and finish it to a cubit from the top and set the door of the ark in the side of it. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. Behold, I, even I, am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life. From under heaven, everything that is on the earth shall perish. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark. To keep them alive with you, they shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, and of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. As for you, take for yourself some of all food which is edible, and gather it to yourself, and it shall be for food for you and for them. Thus Noah did, according to all that God had commanded him, so he did.
I should have figured Mike would read that being a contractor, like that whole thing about the big boat and all that stuff and the building and everything. All right, so Noah's commission from God, verses 14 to 16, right? Build a very specific ark, all right? So we have our world's first cruise ship, all right? Here we go. Wonder where the cruise ship came from? Here's the cruise ship. The mode of destruction. So God himself, okay, again, very emphatic and very specific in the Hebrew. I myself will bring about this worldwide flood. Total destruction. Everything with the breath of life will die. No uncertainty, no ambiguity about what God is going to do. Okay? Now, just kind of try to put yourself in the shoes of Noah, right? It took him a little while to build this ark, right? Do you think he felt like a fool sometimes? You think everybody was kind of running by, hey, you see what Noah's doing down there? He's building this big boat. What's going on with him? Okay, so God is very emphatic. Noah does that. And so the covenant of preservation is inaugurated. Okay, now, verse 18, we get the first use of this word covenant. Okay, first verse of covenant, okay, which is Barith. Okay, so what are the major covenants in the Bible? What are the major covenants?
Abrahamic covenant.
Abrahamic.
The way of Abrahamic. Davidic.
And the new covenant. Okay, some people talk about the Adamic covenant. Okay, not really covenant language in my opinion. Others talk about a few others. Some talk about the Palestinian covenant, which is a re-emphasis of the land. Okay, but the big ones are the Noahic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic or the Sinaitic covenant. Again, Palestinian land is a re-emphasis. The land is really emphasized in the covenant over and over again, which I think is one of the strongest, you know, supports for the literal fulfillment and not spiritualizing the church as Israel. Then, of course, the Davidic covenant and the New Covenant, okay? Now, what are the two forms of biblical covenants? There's kind of two types of covenants. What are they? All right, you guys are too good. Conditional and unconditional, right? So a conditional covenant says what?
If then.
If then, right? If you do this, then I'll do that, right? Unconditional covenant says what?
I will.
I will. I'll do it, okay? No whatever. What are the importance of covenants? Why are covenants important?
Show God's faithfulness.
Yeah, okay. So show God's faithfulness or his promises maybe, if I could stretch it to that word. Why else? Mm-hmm. Okay. So a couple things. They identify God's promises or requirements, right? So unconditional, God's promises. Conditional, his requirements, okay? So it identifies what God's going to do, right? And secondly, it identifies our responsibilities, the then part if it's conditional, or our blessings, the things that God is going to bless us with if it's an unconditional covenant. Now, if we get to the end of this little section, 1 to 11, we kind of want to do one session at the end, and we'll talk a little bit about biblical covenants, okay? Because there's a lot that goes on relative to covenants as kind of an organizing principle for the Bible, okay? So covenants also tend to speak to God's administration of his plans throughout the historical redemptive period. So they're made with different people, different times, and different things, but I think the essential elements are is that they identify God's promises, okay, or his requirements of us. They identify his, they identify our responsibilities or his blessings, okay. So conditional and unconditional from a covenant perspective. Now, while this is the first use of the covenant, it is just a precursor to the covenant, okay. So this is not the actual Noahic covenant, right? So if you go ahead to chapter 9. And you look in verse 8, we'll begin to see, okay, then God spoke to Noah and his sons with him, saying, now behold, I myself, again, this emphasis, do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. And it goes on to list the terms of the covenant, okay? So pretty emphatic language right up front. It's an unconditional covenant that he makes with Noah, okay? And we'll get to that when we get to that section. So it is not the actual covenant, but the idea of covenant, the idea of a covenant promises and relationship through God is introduced here in verse 18. Now, the other thing that goes on here is at this point, God gives Noah some instructions, right? Okay, so, you know, it's not conditional, okay? It's, if you want to argue conditional, it's conditional kind of in the way that Abrahamic covenant is said by many to be conditional. It was conditioned upon him leaving. Well, he did, so it doesn't really matter, right? Or in this case, he did build it, so it doesn't really matter, but there's not conditional language here, okay? So basically, God gives Noah some instructions, right? Build an ark and go into it. Preserve your wives, your sons, and their wives. Take two of every living thing. Emphasis again, what? Male and female. How do we properly reproduce? Male and female, not male, male, not female, female, okay? So this kind of subtle reminder all the time, and take food for sustenance. So, you know, again, I said it a moment ago, you know, I mean, how do you think Noah felt? I mean, this is a big boat, okay? I mean, a cubit, right? A cubit is supposed to be from the tip of your finger to the elbow, so some of us have bigger cubits like Don, some of us like me and Dan have smaller cubits. But it was supposed to be about 18 inches, is what they say, okay? So this is a big old football field. This is a boat that's a big old football field, okay? three decks, very specific things, particular type of wood, sealed up in certain ways, put windows in it, right? And then go through, get food, get a certain number of animals, get everything to redo, and then people just have a field day with this, right? How did you get all the animals in the boat? You know, and, well, maybe they just took eggs. And how did the dinosaurs get in the boat? Maybe they were baby dinosaurs. I mean, you know, there's just so much chatter around it, okay? The point is, there probably weren't as many types of animals back then, right? So we had the seed form or the basic of all the animals back then. How we got them on the boat, I have no idea. I mean, how do you get all the insects to go in there? Hey, come here, mosquito.
Get in the boat.
Yeah, actually, it's a good point. He just stood out there with no off on, right? They had off back then, right?
Yes, I guess.
I must have. So, you know, you get those, you get the mosquitoes, all the bugs. But, you know, so two of everything came. It's on the boat, okay, and he's there. So he has built this big boat, all right? And so this kind of, you know, we've had this buildup now, right? All these verses, 13 or 14 through 21 about do this, build the boat in a certain way, you know, do this, get all these things on it, bring the wives. And then verse 22. I mean, what stands about for about verse 22?
Compared to the rest of the world?
What?
Compared to the rest of the world?
Well, just, you know, in the context here.
It's like, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. He just did it. He did it, right? You know, think of something. Man, think of something that God, what if God had asked you to do this, right? I mean, he didn't ask him, well, does it have to be 300 cubits? Can I make it a little smaller? Can I don't like those mosquitoes. Can I leave them off? I mean, you know, what did he do? He just did it, right? So this is, I think, when you talk about, when you go back to verse 9, it talks about being a righteous man, a blameless man, and he walked with God. I mean, this is the, I think, ultimate expression of he walks with God, right? God said, do this, and he did it.
He did all.
He did all, right. Even better, right? Yeah. He didn't do part of it. He didn't do some of it. He did all of it, right? Just as God asked him to do. So, you know, you want to know what it's like to walk with God? I mean, what's a good idea to walk with God? You know, unfortunately, Nike stole the slogan, right? We have to go buy Nike out, right? Just do it. It's pretty simple. Just do it, right? Simple in word, not always simple in action or in deed, okay? So Noah, to me, is just really kind of an amazingly interesting individual. Complete and immediate obedience, right? Okay, so it wasn't like, yeah, Noah drug his feet for a few weeks and said, maybe I'll wait till next week to get started. He just jumped right in. No questions, no whys, no buts, just did it. Okay, so we come to the end of chapter 6, right? Creation in 1, perfect environment, perfect wife in 2, fall and the curse in 3, okay? The continuation of the cycle of sin with Cain and Abel, the intensification of sin, right? The preservation of a godly line, the genealogy up to Noah, okay? The condition of things on earth, and now we arrive at the last part of this introductory set, okay? So when we pick up our study again, kind of this is how the rest of chapter 7 to 11 play out. And I'm a little short because I didn't put the last one in. So the global flood, okay? So we'll look at chapter 7, and we'll see how I think Moses makes it very clear, or God through Moses makes it very clear that this was indeed a global flood, okay? Everybody wants to argue it's just a little local flood, right? But that much water, that much rain. We all saw Houston, right? Mm-hmm. Now it's just a little thing, right, by comparison. God's covenant with Noah, so then we will see the specifics of the covenant, okay, and how he works that out. Part one, sin still reigns, okay, so here we go, you know. Thought we got rid of it all, we'll blot it all out, but then, oops, still there, okay. So this idea, I think, that God just keeps telling us over and over again is the source of sin is us. Right? It's not anything around you. God wiped it all out. He took the righteous ones, and yet, boom, sin again. Okay, the table of nations. Okay, so we see that. I'll show you a couple pictures of kind of where maybe some of these people are. Okay, again, a little speculation. Sin reigns part two, right? I'm going to build this big tower as opposed to going out like I tell you to do. I'm going to build a monument to myself so you'll never flood me out again. And then we get this narrowing of focus down to the patriarchs, right? So we've covered a lot of years of history up to this point in time, right? Genealogical history. And now when we get to chapter 12, the rest of the book is going to focus on what? How many people? Abraham, Isaac, Joseph. Three people, Okay? So you can see the narrowing down of the line and kind of bringing it back to the process there. Okay? Dan, would you close us in prayer?